The next speaker is Dr. Theo de Witt from the Netherlands. He's going to talk about the impact of comorbidities and treatment in lower-risk MDS, interim results from the EU MDS registry.
Okay, thank you, Stephen, for the introduction, and I would like to thank the MDS Foundation for inviting me to give the first presentation on our EU MDS registry. Today, I will present to you only data which have not been published yet. Actually, we have no official publications from the registry yet. I will explain that to you in a minute. So, a few of the data are published as in abstract form at ASH meetings and EHA meetings. So I would like to acknowledge all these people who are on this first slide, So the people who are here on the first slide, these are all the collaborators from the 14 national registries which are participating to this study. And I would like especially acknowledge Louise de Zwart and Rafael Isiksen, because many of the data I'm going to present there are data from their presentations on Monday by Louise de Zwart and by Rafael Isiksen. But I will go back to that in more detail later on. Why a European-wide registry in low-risk MDS? First of all, it's an elderly population. The average age is around 75 years. So that means that there is, in these patients, a reluctance to complete the diagnostic workup, including cytogenetics and bone marrow investigations. And we realize that in these patients, the main problem is not progression to leukemia, but this are the cytopenias and the progression of the cytopenias. The therapeutic guidelines are more or less based on eminence opinions rather than on evidence. And there is a lack of prospective interventional studies because of lack of good drugs for these patients, but also because of the advanced age of the patients. So that's why we have decided, after long deliberations, to start a longitudinal observational study, which is the registry study, which is linked to observational studies in the patient, clinical observational studies and translational studies. The study design was as such: newly diagnosed MDS patients, so all patients have to be registered within 3 months after diagnosis, because we want to avoid selection bias, which is more or less prominent in the other registries, existing registries. So no selection of patients. IPSS low risk and intermediate one, now called lower risk MDS patients. And we started accruing patients in April 2008, and after 4 years and a half, we had 1,000 patients from 14 countries and 118 sites contributed to this study. The primary objective of the study is to analyze the impact of various disease and patient-related factors, including comorbidity and the impact of disease management on survival and progression-free survival. The secondary objectives were to investigate the correlation between the clinical characteristics at inclusion, secondary iron overload due to transfusions, the administered treatment, and the overall survival and progression-free survival, but also on performance status and quality of life. And I will give you data on the quality of life of our patients in the registry. Here you see the number of patients per country. On the top, you see the patients from France, almost 300 patients. One-third of the patients are contributed by the centers from the very active GFM, by coordinated by Pierre Fenot, and then Spain, and so on, you can see here. So the accrual was from April 2008 to December 2010, and the number of days from diagnosis to inclusion was a median of 42 days after the diagnosis. Age of this registry, median age was 74 years, and you can see from one registry to another there's some variation. Some registries in France and in Spain they have the median age is a little bit higher compared to, for instance, the Netherlands, where the most patients are from our referral centers. This is the WHO classification 2001, but we also can give you the classification according to 2008, because all the data are available. And what you can see here, which is very striking, at least to me it was very striking, that one-third, the most prominent, the most frequent diagnosis was RCMD, so refractory cytopenia with multilineage dysplasia. So more than one-third of the patients belong to that category. What you also can see is that the median age of all subcategories is similar, and of course there is a female predominance in patients with deletion 5q. We can calculate the IPSS score, and here you see the calculation according to the score, just 0.5 and 1, so these are intermediate 1 patients, and you can see that we can give the IPSS scoring system at registration in 95% of the patients. Actually, we are now going back to the cytogenetics because we also want to introduce the revised cytogenetic scoring system, and so now this number will go down because we have more information about the cytogenetics currently than during this analysis. And here you see that we have cytogenetics in about 95% of the patients. Causes of death, and I think this is a very important slide because it shows you that the great majority of patients in this registry, lower risk MDS registry, have died from marrow failure because only a little bit less than 10% of the patients have died after progression to acute myeloid leukemia, and only very few patients have also progressed to more advanced stages. So the great majority of patients have died due to marrow failure rather than due to progression to leukemia. You should realize, if you are doing an observational study like this, that it is not very it's not possible to get a very precise description of the cause of death, because many patients just die at home, so the information about the specific cause of death is not very specific at the precise time point of death, but we know what has happened before the patient has died. This is the overall survival of the patients at 4 years now, of these 1,000 patients. So the survival at 4 years is 75%, and the progression-free survival is around 73%. So if the patient progress, then they die very quickly. This is the overall survival according to the IPSS scoring system. This is 0.5 points and 1 point. This is intermediate 1 patients. And you can see that the IPSS is very predictive for the outcome in these patients, also the early outcome with an average observation time of 2 years of these patients. And the WPSS also includes the transfusion dependency in the prognostic scoring system, and you see that there are similar results. Only the small group of the high-risk patients in the WPSS has a poorer outcome. One of the most important activities in our registry study is the collection prospectively of the transfusion history of the patients, the transfusion services to the patient. And this cartoon depicts the success of our approach because we are able to collect all data in more than half of the registries, and in the other registries we collect almost 90% or more of the data, of the transfusion data. From this we can calculate, because the centers report the hemoglobin level before the transfusion, and you can see that the pre-transfusion hemoglobin level differs from one county to another. So in Romania, the pre-transfusion hemoglobin level is 7, while in Scandinavia, in Sweden, the pre-transfusion level is 8.8. So that means the policy varies from county to country. And we are going to go in detail, more detail, but not at this time, to see whether the transfusion policy has an impact on outcome, positive or negative. To tell you the truth, I don't know exactly what is the best approach, whether you should transfuse the patient at a hemoglobin level of or 7 or 8.8 in general. Of course, the general condition of the patient plays a role as well, so that has to be taken in consideration. But we have this information. At baseline, so at registration, the percentage of patients who are transfusion-dependent also varies from one county to another. This is Portugal, with only 10% of the patients being transfusion-dependent at registration. And this is Poland, which has more than 50% of the transfusion of the patients transfusion-dependent at registration. So that reflects the referral pattern from the general physicians to the internists and hematologists in the hospitals in the various countries. But on general, in the whole registry, 29% of the patients are transfusion-dependent. And also this cartoon is informative. This is the percentage of patients who are transfusion-dependent at the visit. So we collect data every 6 months. So visit 2 is after 6 months, 12 months, and so on. And you can see that the percentage of patients who are transfusion-dependent does not increase in time. That's very, let's say, contradictory to what is usually said in the publications. And this is because patients who become transfusion-dependent, they die more quickly than patients who are transfusion-independent. So in general, the transfusion-dependent patient remains stable over time. What happens to the patient who become transfusion-dependent? So these are patients who become transfusion-dependent through the observation period. So this is not a time-dependent analysis. That is ongoing, but I don't have the data for you right now. And you can see that the patients who become transfusion-dependent do very poorly compared to the patients who are not transfusion-dependent. This is still the majority of patients. These are 520 patients who have remained transfusion-independent from registration, and you can see that the survival curve of these patients is more than 80% of these patients are surviving at 4 years, with now more than 200 patients who have died at this observation time point we are talking about earlier this year. We can study this, the impact of transfusions and the prognostic scoring system using a multivariate analysis, a Cox model, in which we put also the ferritin levels, the transfusion numbers, and the transfusion intensity. And if you subdivide the patients according to the transfusion dependency, then the patients who are transfusion dependent have a 4 times higher chance to die than compared to the 580 patients who are not transfusion-dependent. The same applies to the SPSS score, so it's still very prognostic in this system, as you may expect. This curve shows you some information about the influence of the progression to acute myeloid leukemia on the outcome and the transfusion dependency. We have subdivided the patients, and actually this is a this curve is taken from the presentation by Louise de Zwart. So if you are interested in more details, then come to the poster on Monday evening, and I will be there to explain more details to you. So the two upper curves are patients who have been transfusion independent throughout the observation period. And you can see that the patients who have shown no progression during the observation period. And you can see that in these patients, transfusion dependency plays a major role, a 20% difference in overall survival. I would like to stress that the great majority of patients who have died, 128 patients out of the 198 patients who have died in this analysis, are patients who have died before progression. And here are the patients, the 70 patients who have shown signs of progression before death. And also in these patients, transfusion dependency is an important prognostic and independent prognostic factor for survival. So both in patients who are progressing to acute leukemia or patients who have not progressed, the impact of the transfusion dependent is very prominent. What about MDS treatment? Here you see an overview of the MDS treatment in these patients, and I only give the most important and frequent treatments. So at registration, already 18% of the patients were receiving MDS-specific treatment, and that increased to around 44 to 50%, so just below 50% of the patients received MDS-specific treatment. That means that 50%, more than 50% of these patients have received only supportive care during this observational study. And that's the real life. When we talk about all these presentations here, these patients are not usually in these in the numbers. The treatment with erythropoietin stimulating agents already at registration in 50% of the patients, and it increased to around one-third of the patients. G-CSF was added to a certain subcategory of the patients, and here you see the transfusion dependency again. Iron chelation was, of course, not given at registration, not in a very few patients, and it increased to 8% of the patients. I'll come back to that in a minute. We are still on the impact of ESA treatment. The analysis are still ongoing. Eva Hellström is coordinating that for our registry study. But what I show here to you is the impact of the ESA treatment. So this is just an observational study. The impact of the ESA treatment on patients who were at the time of starting ESA treatment were transfusion independent. And what we show here are the patients who are responding to ESA treatment, the time to the first transfusion after the starting after starting ESA treatment. So this was the time to get the first transfusion in these patients at all. So 40% of the patients became transfusion dependent, even irrespective whether they had responded. But this is much higher compared to the patients who did not show a response. So in these patients, already 50% of the patients had become transfusion dependent. So there's a significant impact of this outcome. This is still a preliminary analysis because we have to take into consideration the time point when the ESA treatment was started and so on. What about iron chelation? In the analysis, we discussed a week ago in York, in the statistical department of the York University in United Kingdom, coordinated by Alex Smith. In this analysis, 74 patients already had received iron chelation, and the majority of patients nowadays have been treated with the oral chelator Deferazirox. The median time to start iron chelation from the start of transfusion to the start of iron chelation is 280 days. So after becoming transfusion dependent, in our registry, the decision to start with iron chelation was after around 7 months in these patients. The mean ferritin values at the start of iron chelation was around 1,800 nanogram per deciliter. Nanogram per liter. So we planned several analyses to assess the value of iron chelation in this observational study. And these analyses, which I'm going to present to you on the next slide, were performed a year ago on a smaller number of patients who had received iron chelation, 55. So what we did in this analysis, we defined a control group within the registry. These were transfusion-dependent patients with a ferritin level more than 1,000 and no iron chelation therapy. That was the control group. So these were transfusion-dependent patients who already had a certain degree of iron loading by the transfusion. You will see that in a minute. And then we compare the two groups, the iron chelation group with the control group. And here you see the data. So when you look at the whole group of 1,000 patients, that this analysis has been performed a little bit more than a year ago, when 55 patients were reported to have been treated with iron chelation. So if you look at the ferritin levels of the two groups, of course, this is quite different. If you look at the adjusted overall survival of the patients who received iron chelation, this is twice as bad compared to the control group who did not receive iron chelation. However, if you adjust the survival with the prognostic factors, which include ferritin levels, number of transfusions, and all the other factors which are prognostic in our registry, then the survival of the patients is three times better to compare to the control group. However, if we now restrict ourselves to the transfusion-dependent patients, and we compare the three groups, the transfusion-independent patients who did not receive iron chelation is the control group, the transfusion-dependent patients who received no iron chelation, and the transfusion-dependent patients who received iron chelation. Then you have three groups. Unadjusted, you see the hazard ratios, but if you adjust the hazard ratio for survival with the prognostic factors as similar as here, then you can see that the hazard ratio for the iron chelated group is becoming better than in the non-iron chelated group. But this is not significant right now. We also restricted the analysis to transfusion-dependent patients who had a ferritin level of more than 1,000, two groups, and here you see that after adjustment, the overall survival of the iron chelated group was twice as good compared to the control group, but this is not significant. As promised, I would give you some data about the analysis performed by Rafael Isaacson from the group of Pierre Fenot. He looked at the prognostic relevance of the kinetics of the worsening of cytopenias in our registry. In other words, what is the impact of the development of the severity of the cytopenias on the outcome of our patients? And he has an oral presentation on Monday during an oral MDS session. So for more details, I refer you to his presentation. So again, our patient population, 1,000 patients. Of course, when you want to study the worsening of the cytopenias, you need follow-up visits. So patients with too few follow-up visits were excluded, 300 patients, and patients who have received disease-modifying treatment were also excluded. So altogether, 530 patients. And what you see here is the number of patients with sufficient data on the hemoglobin levels, the nucleated cells, all the white cells, and the platelets. And here you see the patients who had either a stable slope, a stable curve, or a declining slope. Patients who had curves which is going up and down had to be excluded in his analysis because he could not calculate the slope of the curve. I'm not going into the details. And here you see the median follow-up of the patients, the time to progress to have a decrease of the hemoglobin level with 1 gram per deciliter or 1,000 white cells or 50,000 platelets was around 24 months, 29 months, and 27 months. So in general, the degree of worsening of cytopenias took about 2 years in our patients, to simplify it. And this is the most important slide from his presentation. Here, this is the impact of the worsening of the white cells and the platelets on the outcome. He could not define this for the hemoglobin levels because the patients were treated with transfusions which influenced the hemoglobin levels. So therefore, this was not possible. And the patients who have on the red curves are the patients who have a median, who are above the median. So these are the patients who have a slower development of the cytopenia, of the leukopenia in this case, and of the thrombocytopenia here. And you can see that the outcome of these patients, the survival, is much worse if the development of the cytopenia was faster. In other words. So if the bone marrow failure is fast, then the prognosis of these patients is worse compared to the patients who have a lower development of the cytopenia, showing that the development of the bone marrow failure in our patient population is a prominent prognostic factor, which should be incorporated probably in a time-dependent prognostic scoring system of our patients. We collect the comorbidity in our patients, and right now we have not performed an in-depth analysis, but we are going to incorporate in our analysis the comorbidity, so we are able to do that. You can see there is a variation from one county to another. So in this county, which I cannot read from here, the comorbidity is very low. I think it's Austria, and it's going up to 3.5 to 4 comorbidities in some other countries, like in Poland and then Spain. This just reflects, in my opinion, the referral bias of the patients. As promised in the beginning of my presentation, we collect quality of life data in our patients, and you can, in this cartoon, gives a summary of the completeness of our quality of life data. The EQ5D, the five-dimensional quality of life measurement tool was used as the basis, and you can see that we have collected this data in the majority of patients. What is the impact of the transfusion status on the outcome? And you can see these are the five dimensions of the quality of life. And if you look at the patients who have no problems with the mobility, for instance, then you can see that the patients who are transfusion dependent have a lower chance of having no problems with the mobility. And this applies for the other dimensions, as you can see, with these nice things. You can see it by yourself, and all of them is very significant. If you look at the impact of the decreased quality of life of these patients, I'm not saying that the quality of life by itself is a prognostic factor, but at least it reflects the quality of life of the patients. And if the quality of life is affected, so the green lines are the patients who have no affected quality of life in this dimension, then you can see that the outcome of these patients is better than compared to the patients who have an affected quality of life. This is just the detail. And this slide I received only 2 days ago from York, from Tom Johnston. And what you see here is it's a very complicated slide, but it's not as complicated as it looks like. Here you have the visual analog score. This is a quality of life score with the same five dimensions, which is filled in by the patient. A 100% score means the normal quality of life, and a 0% means that you are laying in your bed dying a few days before you are dying. So this is the quality of life. And every symbol reflects a visit of the patient and a report. This is at registration, this is at 6 months, this is at 12 months, and so on. And what you can see here, there's in the transfusion-dependent patients, these are patients with the red symbols and the red line, they have a lower quality of life at registration, as I explained to you before, but the decline of the quality of life of these patients is steeper than the decline of the quality of life in the patients who are transfusion independent. That's also going down significantly, but very slowly, but it's going down more steeper in the patients who are transfusion dependent. Whether that is induced by the transfusions or it's just not prevented by the transfusions, that is something which we have to study in more detail. There's some animation which requires some clicks for me. So, coming to the conclusions of my presentation on the progress in the EU-MDS registry, so we can now conclude that transfusion-dependent patients have a worse overall survival, especially in patients without progression to leukemia. The responding patients to ESA treatment have a longer transfusion-free period, which may translate in a better survival. We don't have this data yet. Rapid decline of the cytopenias predicts shortened survival. Explanation will come in the near future. Transfusion dependency is associated with a decreased quality of life and a faster decline of the quality of life. And the EU MDS registry contains a unique database in low-risk MDS patients. Right now, we have now more than 1,300 patients in our registry, including patients from new registries like Israel, who have already included 24 patients, and from Serbia and Croatia is going to join us as well. Of course, you realize I did not mention any molecule in my presentation, so maybe this is the only presentation which does not include molecules, but that will change. So we decided that we will collect the molecular data in our registry, and this is one of the highest priorities. And we have submitted a grant application to the EU 7 Framework Program, the last call, in last September. Actually, somewhere today or in this weekend, I'm expecting the outcome of the first step, and then we will know whether we can go to the second stage of this procedure and the submission date of that project, which is called Optimized Management of Patients with Low-Risk MDS using the data from the molecular knowledge we have into our registry. Thank you. On behalf of all my co-workers.